Good morning and welcome to the New Media Show. My name is Todd Cochran. Just a few minutes late start here this morning as I was, for a better word, rebooting some machines. Things for the Trons weren't flowing in the right direction. But everyone, good morning and welcome to the show. This is going to be kind of a kickback, more relaxed show. We're just going to kind of wrap about the space. But of course, I want to give a warm welcome to my co-host, Mr. Rob Greenlee. Good morning, Rob.
Good morning, Todd. Welcome. Good morning. I know it's really early for you, so you better drink a good cup of coffee this morning.
No Java for me. And believe it or not, I don't drink too much coffee. So
I don't either. Actually, this is rare for me as well. But you know, it's great to be here on a holiday weekend here in the U.S. anyway. And I know the rest of the world probably doesn't care.
Well, it is interesting that, sometimes we forget that the rest of the world is on another schedule. I have to remind myself all the time of that. But
Yeah, that's right. And you really probably shouldn't even mention U.S. holidays because the shows listen to, I don't know. I mean, if you looked at our stats, I mean, how many other countries in the world actually listen to the show?
Yeah, all over the place. So it's, the rest of the folks, they have their own version of Labor Day. And at least many countries do. But anyway, hey, I want to welcome our guest, Mr. Sean Thorpe. Good morning, Sean. How are you?
Good morning, Todd and Rob. So glad to be with you guys here on this Saturday morning. I've been listening to the New Media Show well back when it was still called the Saturday Morning Tech Show. Mm. And I've listened to, I've listened to Todd's Geek News Central. And Rob, I was a subscriber to your Digital Life Daily while that was still happening.
Oh,
so.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely pod faded on that a few years ago.
Yeah. But I've been a fan of both you guys for a long time, so I'm real excited to be here this morning.
Well, thank you. We appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. And, one thing that, what I thought is, and just as a matter of disclosure, Sean writes for Geek News Central, and he also does tech support and helps us out at Rawway/Blueberry. But Sean has, been known, or, Sean's one of those guys, and Sean, I'll let you give your own background, but Sean's one of those guys that hangs out on Facebook. He's in Google Plus. He's just about in every podcasting community and always lending a hand, always helping folks that need help. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have Sean on this morning as well, was because oftentimes the folks that are doing the grunt work in the background don't get too much recognition, and I shouldn't even say grunt work, but doing, podcasting work. I mean, basically, helping people with issues. So, that's why, one of the reasons why we wanted Sean part of our team, because he's always helping people. And even now, he helps folks that have non-related issues with competitors' products as well. So, Sean, I know maybe it would be good if you just kind of give everyone just a little bit of a background of your, what you've been, what attracted to you, the podcasting space, what you've done, you and your wife's involvement. I think the audience would like to hear that.
Sure. Thanks, Todd. And, I have, a couple of different ways I can kind of relate the story. There's, the really long, well, maybe not so long story, and then there's more of the condensed version. So I'm going to start with kind of the long view, and if this gets boring, just let me know. But I've been really just fascinated with audio specifically, but kind of technology in general for a long time. When, I was a kid, I got a boombox, I think when I was like 10 years old, and it had a microphone in it, and it was like the most amazing thing that I'd ever experienced because I could record my own voice. And I remember me and my friend Ronnie, we used to record these, dumb little skits that we would make onto cassette tapes. And we would dub the tapes off and give them to our friends. So this was like, 1989, 1990, somewhere in there. So, I'm not saying that I invented podcasting, but, the idea was circulating a few years before, everybody else did, I guess. But after that, when I was in high school, I got real lucky. I was able to attend a vocational center that had a media, they called it media specialist. And it was the first time I really got to play around with things like video editors, all analog, by the way, you know, two huge decks, one on top of the other with VHS tapes in them. So, you know, real old technology, but I really loved it. I just loved the process of going out and getting all the footage and then at the end, you know, combining it into that final thing that everyone would see. I really loved doing that. And then after high school, I went to a broadcasting school. So this was 95 into 96. And that was the first time I actually edited audio on a reel-to-reel tape. And, you know, I see everybody that, complains about editing audio now. And I'm like, yeah, try it with a grease pen and these little tiny strips of adhesive tape that you had to use to basically, you know, hold the reel-to-reel together. And I took an internship at a small local FM radio station, and about 6 months into my internship, this was, you know, right at the beginning of the deregulation of radio in the mid-90s. So this small local station was purchased by a national network, and they came in. It was actually Spanish language radio, which, you know, no one at the station, including me, prior to that spoke Spanish. And as was the trend at that time, they came in, they bought out the station, they, you know, pretty much fired everybody, and they automated most of the programming, and they left, like, you know, a few people behind for sales staff. But because I was an intern, I actually got a chance to work on air for a couple months, because once the sale came down and it was official, all of the full-timers at the station started jumping, and the program director, you know, this was, they had no way to automate the station. If the station was going to be on air, a human being had to be sitting in the studio. So all of us interns got an opportunity to be on air for a while because they had really nowhere else to go. And we were all so eager to just work, you know, and I don't know, I think they paid me $5 an hour, but, you know, I was actually on air and it was fun. And, you know, then eventually the transition happened and the new owners were in and we were all out. And, you know, I kind of just decided at that point in my life that, you know, what I really loved was music, and my experience in radio was kind of enough, and I didn't really pursue it too much after that. And, you know, right around that time, I'd gotten online for the first time and was kind of seeing everything that was going on. And I think, like a lot of people who were kind of creatively inclined or just interested in media in the mid-90s, we were all kind of sitting there looking at the web going, this is going to be everything eventually. It's just a matter of time. And I remember it was in 97, I started just publishing out of the web, which is simple web pages. My ISP at the time gave me, they used to do this thing where you could get like a 20 megabyte little subdirectory on their server. So it was, you know, isp.whatever/my username. And I started just publishing, you know, simple web pages online using Netscape Composer 3, if anybody remembers that. And one of the things that I figured out how to do was you used to be able to download a free, simple, real media encoder. Like, you could download the encoder and a server, and you could create your own real audio mm-hmm. stream, and you had to serve it yourself. And I think I was on 56k modem or whatever, but I figured out one night, you know, I was talking to some friends on like ICQ or something, and I said, hey, I'm going to test this thing out, I'm going to try to broadcast live. So ICQ, there's another callback to the dark ages. And I said, hey, I'm going to test this thing out.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to test this thing out. And, you know, I hooked up a microphone and like a cassette deck or something. And, you know, I played a song and talked for like 2 minutes and just kind of said, hey, can you guys hear this? Does it sound like, you know, total crap, or can you, is there any clarity to it at all? Cause I mean, I could only serve, you know, as fast as my connection was. And, you know, a couple of people said, yeah, it sounded all right. You know, it was probably like a, I don't know, a 14K stream or something. It obviously wasn't going to be great, but it really was kind of like a light bulb moment for me where I went, this is coming. I mean, we're all going to be doing this soon in one capacity or another. And then, you know, I kept doing things around audio just as kind of a DIY enthusiast. I bought a Pro Tools rig and, you know, I was playing in bands and stuff and doing all kinds of just kind of home recording and things through the early 2000s. And I remember, you know, there must have been just something circulating in 2004, because I honestly remember in the summer of 2004, I had bought my first ever actual domain and figured out how to get that online with a shared web host. And I figured out how to do my own, you know, roll my own installation of movable type.
Oh yeah.
Which was not as, you know, I'm sure it's easier now than it was back then. And like, I had no idea what I was doing. And I think I wound up running my movable type under a Berkeley database instead of SQL, which is like, you really don't want to do that. It's really suboptimal, but it worked and now it's all I cared about. So, and I remember not long after that, I had this thought in my head. I'm like, well, I already have some audio recording equipment because of the music stuff that I do. And I have this other stuff. What I'm going to do is I'm going to record my own radio show essentially and put it up online and just, I don't know, maybe somehow people will find it. You know, this was before social media and all that. And then a little later that year, I was on a Yahoo group that was dedicated to a radio show out of Chicago. That's where I'm originally from, for the Chicago area. And there was a guy on there named George Smith. I don't know if anybody remembers him, but he was I don't know that he's still podcasting, but he was pretty active in the space in the early days for at least a few years. And he was a member of that group, and he started talking about podcasting. And I was like, well, I got to check this out. And then in January of 2005, I finally figured out how to get all the parts working. And, you know, I posted my first show. The show was called The Phantom Feed because I was running it on a domain I still own, which is phantompower.org. It does nothing now. It has nothing on it now. It takes care of my email. It does nothing else. But I just tossed it onto a subdirectory there. And I've just been, you know, in and around the space ever then. Ever since then, I've been around a long time. I know nobody's ever heard of me because I've never had a show that's been like popular or successful. But I just love podcasting, and I love, you know, talking about it and helping people out. I love the technology, and every time I could find a group, I would always join. So, you know, I was on the old Podcast Alley forum, the Podcast Pickle forum. You know, I'm sure we all remember the Yahoo group for podcasters, which, you know, it still gets a message every now and then, like once every couple of months, some new person will find it and post on there. So it's not completely dead, but I was active on there. And then that just naturally kind of migrated into social media. And, you know, I do a show still with my wife that we actually started in 2006, and then it kind of rebranded and pod faded and came back. That's very much a, it's very much a kind of podcasting 1.0 experience. It doesn't really have a particular focus. It's just us kind of talking, and kind of my primary goal for the show is I just want to, you know, I just want to make her laugh. I try to entertain her, and you know, a handful of other people enjoy it, which is great. Then last year, Todd, I started, when you launched the Podcaster News website, I was one of the original writers there, and I'm still contributing. And then earlier this year, I joined your team on Geek News Central. And then a little bit after that, I joined your other team over at Raw Voice, helping out with, you know, support issues wherever they may arise, whether that's on the forums over at blueberry.com or whether it's a Google Plus or Facebook group or whatever. So it's
evil master plan to assimilate you.
Yeah. Suck him into the fold. Yes.
You know, no, and I think, you know, what Sean's story is maybe duplicated really a lot in the space. And Rob, I know maybe you even have a similar story with, you know, having stuff in radio. I was probably I came from a BBS/blogging background before, and I always loved the online communities. And I think there's some, you know, there's definitely some parallels when it comes to the content creators and folks that
I had a real Helix servers that I had co-located, as well as I had Windows Media streaming servers. So back in the day, you know, when he was talking about that kind of stuff, it brought back a lot of memories. I even had the Icecast servers running, you know, for Shoutcast and things like that. So I can totally relate, you know, the whole bringing, you know, doing everything on a cassette player, doing it, you know, using a cassette and bringing it home and playing it into a computer and making an MP3 file. I did a lot of that same kind of stuff back in the day as well. So it was, I mean, Sean, you're exactly right. I mean, a lot of the reason that stuff existed back then was because bandwidth was so constrained. And I mean, it was horrible that I had to stream at 16K, but in reality, that was a lot of the, I mean, that, for a lot of people, that was half the bandwidth they were getting was 16K. So it's pretty shocking to think about that now, considering, you know, I've got a cable modem connection here that's 100 megabytes per second. So things have changed a lot.
you know, I've told this story before, but when I started running my bulletin board, I was living in Lemoore, California, and that's the middle of the San Joaquin Valley, for those of you that don't know, breadbasket of America. Or maybe vegetable basket is a better word to say. Well, not so much now because of the drought, but
the salad bowl of America.
Yeah. we started off with, you know, I just think about it, 2,400 baud modems. Yeah. Initially I had a 64 meg RLL hard drive. That was $1,000. You know, and it just, you know, then stepping through time, you know, when we finally got to 56K on the modems, and, you know, we paid $1,000 for a US robotics modem to get 56K. It was, you know, and we were glad because, you know, with the additional speed, and all we were loading was text on the page. We weren't even loading,
yeah,
we weren't loading graphics. And then Windows 3.1 and the birth of Windows 95 20 years ago, that was huge. You know, and then getting on the internet, you know, I was absolutely astounded. I was living in Guam from 1991 to 94, and the bulletin board scene there was huge. There was, you know, maybe 50 boards. No one had nothing to do. You're on an island, right? And I had a little 3-line system that people were dialing into all the time, and it was just a great way to communicate and tell stories. And you become an expert at flaming, because sometimes stuff turned into flame fest and you know, minutia of language and, you know, all the stuff that, and I really, you know, got my chops in that space. And so it makes you pretty thick skin when you're dealing with someone that is, you know, having a bad day or bad month or bad year, but, or maybe even a bad life. But I think we were getting shareware was the big thing of the day. No one probably even, half the audience probably doesn't even know what shareware is anymore, but
yeah.
Shareware was where you would
free
go up,
software.
Yeah, you go out and buy it, you'd get some software, and sometimes it was free, you could just use it, and then sometimes they'd ask for a small registration fee, and you'd mail them a check, and maybe 3 months later, maybe you'd get a registration code back. Yeah. There was no such thing as email in those early days. We had this, and it was remarkable what was actually set up. There was a system called FidoNet, and I'm sure there's still FidoNet hubs running. I ran a FidoNet hub here in Hawaii for many years, and Guam is also was the regional hub, and that was how we communicated back and forth because the internet didn't really exist, and to think we've come from that to where we are now, where it's just second nature to be in a hangout or do what we're doing right now on Skype. And it's been an amazing ride. And I think that the, you know, as we look back, let's go back to the 2004 time period. Mm-hmm.
Mobile podcasting started.
Yeah. And mobile phones were, you know, essentially,
dumb.
Yeah. They were dumb.
There was nothing special about them.
No.
If you were walking around with like a Motorola StarTAC, you know, you thought you were at the top of the game back then, I think. I know I didn't have a smartphone until, 2009. I think was when I got my first iPhone, 3G. So,
yeah. And to think, you know, now we just, you know, we almost interchangeably go from tablet to iPhone to a computer.
Sure.
You know, and it, you know, depending on the application. So, you know, the medium back in 2004 when it launched, it was truly...
Bob's got it there, the antenna.
Oh, yeah. You know, if you think about it, it was truly revolutionary because, you know, you talk about the struggles you had distributing audio and bandwidth concerns and then to be able to just drop a file up on a server someplace, link to it with a, you know, at the time, an XML file. And have a application actually go out and grab that media. That was, oh my God. Oh, you know, like we are going to conquer the world, you know, with this. And it was all about, you know, and people take it for granted now, but the barrier to entry into, and you know, and we need to really think about this from time to time from the genesis of the podcasting space. When podcasting launched, there was no way. YouTube didn't exist yet. There was no way to essentially be online. You could have some audio on a web page, but there was no way to distribute it. You know, it was hard. And you couldn't get on TV. You couldn't get on the radio. It was all controlled. And when
it's really frustrating too.
Yeah, you know,
you had to wait so long to get something too.
You know, and lawyers and money and you know, payola, you name it, and then all of a sudden we have this ability to do exactly this to the man.
And visual show this morning.
You know, and for those of you that were listening, I just flipped off the cameras. We were able to.
And stick it to the man.
It was sticking it to the man, and we were able to go around him. Now, people take that for granted right now.
That's true, yeah. You know, I what I always think about is, for me, the do-it-yourself mentality was always, I guess, ingrained. I mean, yeah, I went through a period where I wanted to work in radio, and I mean, I don't know, if someone offered me a job now, I'd probably consider it, but I was always fascinated with the idea of, you know, I want to build my own thing. I want to roll my own thing that's mine, and I control it, and I can do what I want with it. I mean, I remember back, like right when I got out of high school, I was looking into essentially, okay, how can I build my own pirate radio station? And
right.
You know, I would find these catalogs, and they had, and there's another thing you don't think about anymore. I can remember what it was like looking up things like, you know, music equipment or different types of equipment back in, you know, before the internet. And, you know, I would go to the library and like find, you know, I was writing, I was sending out, you know, self-addressed stamped envelopes to, you know, because a lot of the manufacturers, they would have their mailing address down at the bottom. And I would just send out self-addressed stamped envelopes everywhere going, hey, send me any information you have. And sometimes I'd get stuff back. Sometimes I wouldn't. They put me on a mailing list, whatever. But that was the kind of thing you had to do. And I remember looking in the backs of like some of these electronics catalogs, and they had these mail order companies where you could buy low power FM transmitters from small Canadian companies, because I guess in Canada you can run a low power FM station without any kind of license. I don't know how true that is or if it's still true, but that's what I believed 20 years ago. And I remember I called one of them And I said, yeah, I'm in America and I kind of want to buy one of your transmitters. And they went, well, it's not really legal for you to do that. You kind of need a license. And so if you can get a license, you know, call us back. And that was kind of the end of it. But the thinking was already there in my mind. And then when the internet came along, it was just obvious that this was eventually going to evolve. It was going to get more rich. It was going to get more dynamic. It was, you know, bandwidth was going to improve and we were all going to get there. You know, I spoke earlier about putting my first podcasting site online in early 2005. And it was like I had kind of all the concepts in place, but the thing that was hard was getting everything to work together. And, you know, we have all these dynamic tools now for, you know, just publishing to the web. I mean, you know, Blueberry does this, a lot of different companies. Spreaker is a good example. You know, there are many others now where you can just do everything in some cases from inside an app on a mobile device, and you don't have to worry about, oh, well, my website's over here and my RSS feed is doing this and my media hosting is whatever. And, you know, it's fantastic. I think it's great, but it does kind of give you some pause when you think back to what it was like, you know, 10 plus years ago around that time. So,
and, you know, I just think of the scale of things too. You know, I had at the time, you know, let's go back pre-2004 when the VBS scene was still pretty hot. It was, you know, it ran all the way up through, it's, I think there's still boards online now. But when we started, and the thing was about having, you know, how you attracted people to the website was having new software, having new content, and people were fighting to dial in to get the latest shareware downloads to see what new games and stuff were out. And I had probably the biggest shareware collection on the West Coast. That was one of my prides of having like over a million shareware programs. Now, who in their right mind would look through a million programs? But they did, and my library was deep. And to keep that all online, because hard drives were not cheap, you know, I would buy, like, on wholesale, I would find scuzzy CD racks that I could stick 18 CDs into, and that would be, they'd all be mapped to be able to, you know, grab the, and sometimes they would shuffle. I'd be sitting in the office, and I would hear the CD machine, chin, chin, chin. It was shuffling a CD in to get to the file to so the guy could download it. All those files today, when I shut my board down, I archived everything, and they're on like a single, like two terabyte drive or something, right. You know, and I think of the thousands, tens of thousands of dollars that we spent, you know, having all that other equipment, and it's, you know, kind of like in this one platter now. Same thing with the podcasting space. You know, we're at a time now where, like you said, you just grab the mobile phone and you can record a show and you don't need all this. It's cool. So I'm happy for the space, and that's the reason why the space is growing 3,000 to 5,000 new shows a month. It's because it's become much, much easier to do this, and people have more opportunity to create content. At the same time, have more opportunity to fail, but at which a lot of new shows do. But you know, Rob, you think back. You know, and it's funny, Sean, you said movable type. I was a hardcore movable type user for years. Yeah. I thought they were going to beat WordPress. And finally, I had to kind of wave the white flag. I don't know how many years ago that was, but when I moved off movable type to WordPress, to me, it was a, da-da, you know, things become much, much easier. And I don't know why I fought it so long, but it was hard. It was hard in those early days.
Yeah, and one thing that can be fun to do is to go, and I just did it, is to go to the Wayback Machine from the Internet Archive and go look up some older websites.
Yeah.
And you can get a glimpse of what things were like a little bit. You know, I went and just looked up the old webtalkradio.com site that I had back up in 2004, right when podcasting started. You know, just to look back at, I mean, it's amazing how they've cached all that stuff. you know, yeah. like the whole website is there, you know, even though it's been down since, I don't know, 2005 or six or something like that.
And but, my ability to put screenshots up today is down, so I can't put any screenshots up today.
I've
had a technical failure again.
Well, you have a pretty complex studio there, Todd, so I can totally understand that.
You got a network switch that's on the fritz, and I think it's the culprit. So, but I'm like a good soldier. I have a backup, so I think that one will be coming out, a new one going in this afternoon. So, just
Todd,
it's down here. I don't want to have to get in.
Yeah, you really are kind of the, you know, in a lot of ways, the antithesis to what I was saying earlier about, well, you know, all you need is one of these. And Todd's like, no, I need a TriCaster, and then I need, you know, three or four different computers and network switches and routers and all this other kind of stuff, which is totally my, you know, the way I would go. I mean, I'm constantly dreaming of all the gear that I want to own. But the thing that's great about it, though, is you really don't need much more than, you know, what any of us are using, and in some cases less is fine. And that's one of the things that I've always loved about this medium is it, you know, I know that I listen to shows where it's just one person using, you know, a $50 USB mic and it sounds fine. And then Todd, I listen to your show, you know, where you have, you know, all this different, you know, equipment, and that's great too. And I still love podcasting for that reason. I know a lot of people are, you know, there's always this constant kind of talk about the amateur side or the non-professional side or this or that. I love it for the fact that there is still a relatively low barrier of entry, and somebody's running a weed whacker or a lawnmower outside. I don't know if that's getting picked up.
No, so far, so good.
Okay, cool.
You know, I think too is, you know, if I look back, this gear came in the studio very early on. So if I had to rebuild the stack now, it would be much different. It would look a lot different. But it's there. It works. It doesn't need to be replaced.
I mean, so the new equipment, would it be smaller?
Oh, yeah.
More compact, more capable?
Oh, yeah. Smaller, you know, maybe not as capable, but it'd be smaller. Mm-hmm. You know, there's certain things that I have here that can't be replaced with a digital or with a, you know, with a plug-in in a software package. But, you know, it's you just don't take stuff and throw it in the trash. So you use what you have.
Yeah.
Well, and if you get good quality audio equipment, it's going to last, you know.
Yeah.
Well, and the other thing too is, I mean, you know, you don't need even, it's kind of like we talk about this a lot in podcasting, kind of what the different levels of equipment are. And, you know, people want to have this really great sounding, you know, show or whatever. And I understand that, but it's like the other side of it is, okay, you can start with the $40 to $80 USB mic or whatever. And that's, you know, if you're just like using, you know, the built-in mic on your computer or whatever, then that's going to be a huge jump for you. And that's not a big investment. But like I have here, you know, I have certainly less than $1,000 worth of equipment here. And the point that I'm just trying to get to, I guess, is even if you want to try to level it up from where you are, you don't necessarily have to go from, you know, the plug-in mic to, you know, Todd's TriCaster and everything
else.
Well,
you don't have to go from the plug-in mic to a $1,500 mic.
Exactly.
All right.
Exactly. I mean, I'm not using a $1,500 mic. That's for sure. I don't think any – I think my iMac is, you know, around that when I bought it, $1,500. It was a little more than that. But, you know, everything else here, most of this was under a couple $100. So,
you know, I just bought – all the gear for the new studio we're building at the office at the Raw Voice Blueberry office in Columbus. And I bought two mics, two of the Shures that Rob's using, SMB7s. Mm-hmm. I bought a mixer. I bought headphones, a headphone splitter. What else? Heil boom mics, table mounts, cables, What else did we get? All interconnection for two Skype connections. The line levelers so that we don't have crossover noise. And just a handful of other things. I think the grand total was $1,500. And I bought two mics, you know, and two stands. So, you know, that was, you know, that's an extra
these
four
mics
or five.
Are pretty expensive, too. They're $350 bucks a piece.
Yeah, so.
That was the mics and the stands were probably half your investment.
Yeah, yeah. There. And the mixer was $229 or something you know. So, you know, and I got everything that they're going to need, minus one set of cable that's back ordered. But, it'll take them longer to set it up than it did for me to order it. And I just went through click, 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 got what I needed. And, you know, it's being shipped for free on Amazon and, you know, be there Tuesday. And that's another thing is, you know, if I think about how much easier it is that today you can get a suggestion, go online and you buy it. It's delivered in 3 days. And, you know, you're like, wow. When I started, I was actually on travel. I was in Texas at the time and, you know, went across the street and got to Walmart and got a LabTech headset. That's what I used for, you know, the first dozen shows. But then I had to go to a guitar center. I had to drive 3 hours to a guitar center to get my first mixer and my first microphone. And that was a, you know, matter of fact, that first microphone is up in that cabinet back there still. I still have it. The first mixer is long gone, but just the ability to be able to do all that today online makes it a lot. The barrier to entry and all the sites that give you suggestions. Mm-hmm. The barrier to entry. You know, I am a little bit of a snob when it comes to mics. I'm not a big fan, and I've said it publicly a number of times, of that ATR 2100. It's a great mic, but I always have this... Well, methodology. I think podcasters should invest in the best mic they can from the beginning. But
yeah. I mean, for the money, there's really no beating it. Right.
Right.
I mean, it's
for the money.
It's got good sound quality for $59 or right. I think it's on sale for like $40 right now. I mean, I've compared it to this microphone, and you know, for most situations, you're hard pressed to hear much of a difference. I mean, unless you're just a real connoisseur of this stuff. But there is a, you know, I'm with you, Todd. I mean, I spent years using condenser mics, and it was like,
that's what I've always used is condensers.
Yeah, four or $500 mics. This is a $350 mic. I think you pay for what you get when you get into microphones. The big thing about this microphone is the rear rejection that it has.
Right.
It's second to none in that. And if you're using this in front of like a big screen monitor, like a, you know, like I have here, I have a 24 inch monitor that's right in front of me. You have bounce back issues and a lot of mics, if you don't have rear rejection, will create like a little mini echo.
Well, this is a situation with this mic. There is I do get a little into the back of this mic.
Oh, you do? Okay, so it's a two-sided mic?
It's not, but it's still, you know, it's got an open mesh here, so I get a little bit in. Mm-hmm. So it is one of those situations where, you know, and for me, I fell in love with this mic. Because, and again, if we really look at mics and really want to be a snob, I've got a PR40 on the shelf that I can't use, not for my voice. But I tried a PR 20 or 30. I love that mic. That mic was perfect for me. So I think it's always important, too, if you are going to spend the big bucks, you know, make that trip and get into into the Guitar Center studio or wherever it may be, and, you know, have them plug that mic in and talk into it and listen to yourself. For me, it was, you know, some mics work for some voices. There is, you know, the PR40 and the RE20, I love those mics. They're beautiful. They're great, but they're not for my voice. And I think people find that. They'll find a mic that works well with their voice. I think that's part of it, too.
And I think that's part of the equation. Sorry to cut you off there, Rob. But
that's fine.
That's part of the equation that we it can be a challenge when people are starting out. You know, they always ask the most simple kind of generic questions. What should I buy? Mm-hmm. And it's there's no one size fits all answer for everyone. You know, I podcasted for years with a $99 condenser microphone.
MXL 990 is my first mic.
Yeah, the one I had is probably similar to that. I bought it at a local shop. It was, you know, just a very generic condenser mic. But I actually found it sounded decent for my voice. I have a fair amount of baritone in my voice, and the microphone seemed to handle it well. And I actually had a few people reach out to me and go, "Hey, man, when, you know, what are you using for your mic?" And I think they were probably disappointed when I didn't write them back and go, "Well, I'm using a PR40 or, you know, like now I'm using an RE20 Electrovoice." And, you know, I bought this mic somewhat, well, sight unseen, because I don't live in an area where I have something like a Guitar Center where I can go and try out a bunch of different mics. So I bought a couple of used RE20s on eBay. And I'll admit, I don't love the RE20 as much as I thought I was going to. I think my wife's voice sounds fantastic on hers, but I've done a lot of tweaking and have kind of struggled to make this one, you know, sound decent to me. And it just shows you that it's not an automatic thing that getting a, you know, I don't want to say high end, because
it's true. You have to dial them in,
but you know, you're not going to automatically go from, "Oh, I sound pretty good," to "I sound amazing" by just upgrading the mic. There's more to it than that. So if it were me, you know, right now I did some more dialing in on this one last night, and right now I'm kind of happy with it, but I've had that move where I thought, well, maybe I should get the PR40 or the SM7B or something like that, because maybe it would handle my voice better. But, you know, it's a thing that if you get too caught up in it, it never ends. So
the thing I found about the RE20 and the PR42 is that you have to have really good amps. You have to have a really good mixer behind it. If you don't buy the mic. If you've got a $49 mixer, that's not the mic to plug into. That type
they're
of
gain hungry for sure.
Right. They are. They're gain hungry.
Yeah. I've got a Behringer MDX 4600, preamp that's, you know, going through my, insert on my Mackie mixer here. And without it, you know, the RE20 is like everything has to be completely cranked all the way. So
the, what I end up doing is it becomes such a frustration for me when I was early on changing mics and trying different solutions. So I was experimenting for quite a while, went through half a dozen mics, returned mics, is that I went and spent big bucks. I bought a Solo 610, which is a mic preamp, and you know, that costs as much as most people's studios do. But that was a personal choice, but I also had an ulterior motive, and I've told this many, many times. My goal is to sit down and record and hit stop and be done.
Yeah.
You know, and I do a little stuff with the phonic, and that's it. And that's all it gets done for this show. And is it perfect? It's as perfect as I want it to be. And we have tweaked from years, you know, time to time. But I think it's all, again, subjective. Let's kind of change up topics a little bit about some of the trends that we're seeing in the space right now. Sean, you're kind of on the front lines dealing with people all the time. I get the sense that we are entering an era where there's a lot of handholding that we're going to have to be doing. What are you seeing out there?
Yeah, you know, it's funny how we talk about the evolution of the publishing platforms, but there's still a lot of work to be done. And, you know, it all depends on what people want to do. You know, there are obviously free services, apps and things that you can use. If all you said was, "I just want to do simple recordings, get them out online. I don't care about branding. I don't care about a website," what have you, then, you know, there's definitely some apps out there. Audio Boom comes to mind. I'm sure there are others where it's, you know, there's almost no friction. You just press record and you're done. But I think the challenges that I see a lot of people running into now, if they want to be a little more serious about it. They care a little more about branding. They want to have a website. You know, I think there's a big need right now for a relatively simple system for that. But then also too, everybody has all these different desires for what they want. So, you know, they want their website to look a certain way. They want their, you know, or they want to be included in a lot of different apps or whatever. And I think the way in 2015 that a lot of people come to podcasting, which is obviously going to be different for our own experiences because we were there, you know, we were all there before iTunes, certainly. But I think a lot of people get into podcasting now through whatever that entry point is. So if it's, you know, the iOS podcast app or iTunes or Stitcher or wherever they kind of start consuming podcasts, they kind of think, if I'm going to start my own podcast, I want to be able to get to there, you know? So there's some struggle there because, you know, different services have different requirements. And then there's this whole thing of, you know, RSS feeds, while it's a technology that's imminently simple, it's we're laughing because it is. I mean, if you could get just down to a base RSS feed that, you know, you just have, you know, an RSS 2.0 feed that just has the stuff in there for podcasting. So, you know, your iTunes tags, your, you know, your enclosures, all the stuff that you need in there. You know, once you kind of get over the ability to understand how it works, it's not really that complicated, but yet it's easy to just put something in there that throws it off. And that's another thing too. There's still a lot of work that needs to be done. I don't know what the solution there is because I don't think we're ever going to get beyond relying on RSS. So we just have to accept that it's kind of this backbone thing, and like it or not, it's going to be there. So, you know, we need to maybe work on, I don't know, having systems in place that can kind of warn us beforehand that, you know, having this particular text in a you know, whatever system you're using to generate your feed, having, you know, this particular text character or something there is going to break your feed, or, you know, this looks a little weird. I don't really know, but to say that everything is perfect and wonderful and it's super easy now is not entirely true, you know, depending on what you need. And it's a real challenge to kind of find that balance of getting what everyone wants in their, you know, podcast publishing experience, I guess. And I also think, you know, we're going to start to see a rise in, as more and more people come into the space, first as consumers, and then they're interested in getting into publishing. I seem to be seeing this question a lot more now, which is, how do I get onto a network? And I think that's going to be a thing that more and more people are going to be interested in. And it's either because they don't entirely understand what networks do, or they think that that's going to somehow make their own, you know, publishing situation easier, or they're going to automatically get more traffic. I don't really know all the reasons why, because I always kind of approach everything from the perspective of, I'll do it myself first. And if there's a really good reason to do something like join a network, well, then I'll weigh those options out. But I would never come into it with the idea that, oh, I'm going to start a podcast and I'm going to get onto, you know, Network X or whatever. It reminds me of back, you know, 20 years ago when I was playing in bands, and I got a plane going over right now. I don't know if you can hear that, but 20 years ago when I was playing in bands, and the end game for everybody was, we got to get a record deal. Because it was the only way to do anything. And I think there are people who are coming into the space and they're looking at some of these newer, you know, kind of successful startup-y type podcasting content, whatever companies. And they're thinking, oh, well, I got to start a podcast and I got to get into that company or onto that platform. And, you know, or onto whatever network. And, you know, that's kind of a whole other thing. But I think more and more people are thinking about that. That's kind of forefront in their mind. Whereas when we all started, there was nothing like that. You just started. So,
you know, one of the things that, you know, the way I look at the space today is, and it really kind of, I don't know if it's three categories or two, but there's the, you know, a real easy way, you know, you can get in, sign up and everything's just kind of handed to you. But you, to do that, you give up a lot. And, you know, you give up brand, you give up, you know, you're sure you're going to be on iTunes, but you really have no place to send people that's, I personally would want to send people to a site that I'd want to go to that would be presentable. So, you know, there's the easy, that's like easy. And then there is, you know, the more traditional, what I personally believe is a best practice way, you know, kind of, you know, you got to go through and get a, you know, .com and set up a website and get your branding in place and, you know, add the tools to make sure that you're going to be podcast ready. And that's harder. And what I find, sadly, is I find a lot of people start easy, and then within like 90 days, they're like, oh my God, what have I done? And get me out of here. And so, you know, the transition, people have to transition from what was easy to something that is a little more robust and a little more controlled and quite frankly, a platform that gives them more publishing ability. So, you know, I think that's kind of what I see happening. And there's some folks are just, you know, they're happy being on those very simple systems and not getting any SEO and just doing their show and, you know, kind of just going along. I don't know. I guess it all depends on the individual's goals too. Some folks just want to create content and be easy and they don't want to be bothered. But, you know, I've always had the mindset that if you're going to do something like this, why, and don't take this the wrong way, don't half-ass it. You know, do it the right way to begin with. But that's not the mindset of some folks.
Yeah. Well, it's still not that easy to do this stuff. I mean, I think it's getting easier. But I think there's also a lot of pressure the person feels to get it right from the beginning.
And, yeah, I think there's too much pressure.
Yeah. And I think it does cause people to get frustrated. You know, I'm working with a bunch of shows that have been around for a long time and they're trying to take their shows to the next level. And it's just like, oftentimes they've built what they're doing on proprietary systems or ones that, you know, aren't really kind of like, commonly used out there. I mean, they're like custom. I mean, really custom stuff.
Yeah.
And it's almost impossible for them to move. And it just locks them in. Actually, I'm working with a couple different shows that are trying to move away from their systems. And and Todd, one of the shows is on PodPress, right?
Do they know PodPress is? Got security vulnerabilities?
Oh, I know. And that's part of the problem. I mean, the show's been using PodPress for like, I don't know, 10 years or whatever. And well, it's like,
they do know we've got
episodes in there.
They do know we have a conversion program in PowerPress that will convert that PodPress, the entire PodPress.
Well, that's good to know. I didn't know that for sure. So,
yeah. Okay. It'll suck everything in and convert everything over, and then they'll have to do some tweaks, but they can then dump. And then they can migrate to something else, but it might get them from point A to point B to get to C.
Yeah.
You know.
Because right now the guy can't upgrade his WordPress blog either. Oh. Because if he does, it's going to break everything. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's just there are a long time. You know, he's more of a radio right. guy, but there are people out there that have been doing this for a long time and that feel boxed into old technology because they just don't want to grasp the scope of what it takes to upgrade, right? Or it's too expensive, or it's too complicated, or they just don't want to spend time in it, and they just continue using this old technology for fear that, well, it works today, and it's going to work next week, and it's going to, you know.
Until a hacker comes along.
Yeah, I mean, it may or may not, but it's been working up till now, right? And they just think that they can just stay on it forever. And it's like, You know, I mean, there's other shows that I come across that are hosted on really custom platforms. They're not getting any metrics.
Right.
They don't even know how many people are downloading their shows. And it's like, you know, who's listening or anything, but they want to get into a, you know, a monetization model. And I just tell them, well, you really can't do that until you have an idea of how big your show is. I mean, and some of these podcasts have been around for, you know, 8-9 years. They've just been plugging away, and they just don't know how big their audiences are or how many people are listening or anything. So I think you have that spectrum that's going on too in the space. It's not as common. I think there's the other end of the spectrum, which are what we saw at Podcast Movement, which are a lot of new people getting in the space that really know nothing and are looking at this from a marketing perspective, right? And aren't really looking at it necessarily from a content perspective or even know that much about distribution of their shows and are so dependent on these podcast coaches to hold their hand through this process. And it's and you know, a lot of these folks need to dig in and do some searches in Google and listen to some podcasts about podcasts and really start to learn themselves independently and not be so dependent on these coaches that may or may not know really what they're talking about.
You know, I had to laugh, and not to disparage anyone at all, but I had heard someone got $5,000 for a one day. He had got 20 people to spend $5,000 each on a one day podcasting course. And, you know, good on him. If he can get people to spend that kind of money on a podcasting course, you know, more power to him. But, I kind of did a tongue in cheek thing on Facebook. I said, hey, you know, take that $5,000, buy a airline ticket to Hawaii, stay at an oceanfront hotel for a whole week here. And then one day of that week, come hang out with me. Give me $1,000. We'll get your show up, launched, and rocking in that 24 hours. And you'll have, you know, all that consulting with me. And then buy your gear at the same time and go home with some money in your pocket. So, you know, that was kind of my tongue-in-cheek way of saying there's probably a better way to spend your money. But at the same time, you know, if folks would just, you know, and someone said, well, I'll take you up on that, Todd. And I was joking. You know, this is if someone wants to come to Hawaii and spend and come pay me $1,000, spend a day with them, come on down. Come on now. Be happy to accommodate you. We'll spend all day Saturday or Sunday together, and you'll walk out of here with everything I know. But if people listen to this show, and this is what I said later in the Facebook thing, I'm like, you guys know I was being tongue-in-cheek. You just listen to the media show, and you can get ideas from all bunch of luminaries, people that are in the podcasting space doing this. Take all the ideas from all these people, and you know, the 8 or 10 hours that they're going to spend on this course with this individual that they've just spent $5,000 with, they could spend a whole weekend and listen to 20 or 30 hours of great content about a large variety of topics and probably walk away with a fire hose worth of information to get started. And if you need to hire a coach to get your site online and all that stuff, great. But I think there's, yeah, but we live in a society right now that is, give it to me and give it to me now. I don't care what it costs.
Yeah.
You know, my perspective on this from a few different angles is, it seems like fairly regularly, once every couple of weeks, maybe, I deal with someone who needs help with a podcasting site, whether that's through, you know, the work that I'm doing with the Blueberry support team or just on my own from trying to help people out. I talk to people who don't even know what their podcast RSS feed is. So yeah. It's like, you know, we have to do this really base level of troubleshooting just to discover, okay, we understand that you're having a problem, you know, your RSS feed is having issues or your iTunes listing isn't updating or whatever the case may be. And I'll go, well, what's your RSS feed? And they won't even know. And I'll have to do, you know, I'll have to use some tools to kind of work out, okay, this is where we need to start so we can kind of go from there. But this is, you know, maybe a danger in having, you know, these tools that are easier to use to the point where, you know, I personally, anytime I can, this is just kind of how I operate. I want to try to have at least a fundamental understanding of the principles before I get into the doing of the thing. You know, I love learning from the ground up, as it were. So for me, when I learned how to podcast, some of that was already there. I understood that I had to have a media file. I had to have a place to serve it and an RSS feed. And eventually, through my own research and kind of tinkering, I was able to make all that work. I understand that not everybody's going to want to do that. It's just one of those things, you know. I could probably, fix, I don't know, a plumbing issue at my home, but I don't know that I really want to. And in the long run, I'm probably better off just hiring a handyman or a plumber, depending on what it is. So I understand that there's people who go, I want to start a podcast for whatever reason, and I don't want to kind of learn all that ground level stuff. I just want it to be as plug and play as possible. I mean, I understand why people want that. But, you know, there's a danger there in not having at least some fundamental understanding of that. And I've never taken anybody's podcasting course. I've toyed with the idea of creating one, and I might. But if I do, you know, or even if I didn't, you know, sometimes I think about putting out just a simple, you know, one sheet for people that says, you know, you fill in the blanks. This is where my media is hosted. This is what my RSS feed is. And then they can just always go back to it in case something breaks down. And I think, you know, something like that could be important because, again, not everybody kind of learns those sort of basic things that a lot of us, I think, take for granted. And it doesn't help that, and I haven't done this in a while, but I'm sure if you just go to your favorite search engine and type in how to podcast, you're going to be assaulted with resources that are 8, 9, 10 years old. And so much of that is outdated. I think that's one of the ways that a lot of people get wrangled into FeedBurner, because there's all this old material that says, oh, well, FeedBurner is the best thing ever. You should use it. And of course, we know differently now. But that doesn't help all of us in general. And I don't know that there's any way to fix that because we can't really change how search engines work. But
especially, you know, if the search engine owns FeedBurner.
That's a good point. That's a good point. You know, it's a challenge, and I guess what it tells us is while there's been, you know, a good evolution of these things, you know, we still have a long way to go, which is probably good news for all of us, especially those of us that, you know, have a stake in the publishing and hosting space.
You know, and Rob, I'll let you jump in here. One of the things that we, you know, I really realized after having gone to the last two or three podcasting events is that from a ingest standpoint, in other words, the time that person hits, you know, and I'm looking at it from a business perspective, from the time they hit the website until they launch their show, it's got to be a smooth progression process that they can understand and wrap their brain around. And that's one of the reasons why we've taken a little longer getting PowerPress sites out, is because I wanted that ingestion process to be smooth. I wanted to be able to sign up. I wanted to be able to have them come into the first page. They said, "In oh yeah, here's these basic questions, a couple of steps, and boom, we're ready for your content." Now, if you want to go back and tweak and make some changes, you can. But the idea was to be able to quick start them and get them in, and not make it so that it's easy. And that is a critical part in today's space, because as we have found out that, again, the knowledge level, people just don't want to learn any of this stuff. And I don't blame them. If they're not a geek and they're not techie, they're a creative type, that's what they want to do. They want to create. They don't want to dig around for a bunch of stuff.
Yeah, and I think that there's a lot of, I felt it here over the last few years a real need in the market for 360-degree solutions. I mean, ones that are turnkey, ones that are pretty easy to deploy, that follow all these principles that we've been talking about. But the, you know, from the whole spectrum, right? From monetization to hosting and distribution.
We're close.
Yeah, and I think that there are some platforms that are getting close to that. And I think the question that I'm starting to raise is, okay, once we reach that point, right? What does that mean for the space? What I mean, when it's so easy to do this and everybody is able to maximize everything, and you know, you're in all the directories. You've got an app. You've got easy publishing. You can do live streaming. You can do everything. How does that change the space when it becomes so easy to do this? I mean, you automatically get a website, kind of like what you guys are doing. I mean, how does that change the dynamic of this over the long period? Does that mean that there's going to be a lot more people doing this, or does it just mean that everybody that's doing it is doing it the same way? I think it's an interesting question.
I think it. I think you and I'm trying to bring about best practices, at least the way we define our philosophy of best practices, and that doesn't match our competitors' idea of best practices. Mm-hmm. But the philosophy that we have as a company for those types of best practices will at least give everyone an even playing field. They'll be able to be individualized. It's not going to look like a cookie cutter. And they're going to then be able to focus on what's important is the content. In the end, the content wins. And if we can make it easier for people to create great content without worrying about, I guess for a better word, all the BS, the better. And the content's going to rise to the top. And I think you're still going to see the same amount of failure rates. I still think you're going to see shows that don't ever get traction for whatever reason. And, you know, let's be honest, not everyone should be a content creator. And if you're doing it to have fun and don't care, and I've always, you know, this has been my philosophy from the beginning. As long as I'm having fun, I'm doing the show for me and for my audience. You know, so, you know, if I can have fun and have a good time doing it, who cares about the rest of the semantics? Now, there's different goals for different people. Some people are doing this for business reason, and they want to get traction and want to become an expert in their field, or want to prove they're an expert in their field, or, you know, have another outlet for what they're doing now. It's all great. And, you know, there's different strokes for different folks. But I think sticking it to the man, right? It comes back to that.
Last Wednesday, I had on Chris Christensen, who does the Amateur Traveler podcast, and I asked him this question. I asked him, so when you think about your content, you know, you're traveling the world, or you're talking about different areas that you travel to, I mean, what drives you to come up with what content that you create, and are you thinking about your audience and what they want to have? And his answer, I mean, he almost laughed. He said, I don't think about the audience and what they want. I cover content that I have an interest in.
Right.
And because that's what's going to keep me doing this show every week. If I did only what the audience or what I thought the audience wanted every week, I'd probably get bored and stop doing the show.
Yep. Me too.
So, you know, you're, as a content creator, you know, you have this struggle, right? I mean, if you think about it, a lot of Hollywood and a lot of television and radio, they tend to think probably more so what the audience wants. And that could or could not be, it could be a good thing. It could be a bad thing. It depends on your perspective on what you're doing the show for, and who you're doing it for, and what your motivations are. I think that there is something to be said for creating content based on what you think your audience wants. But I can see the point. You know, what's going to get me excited to get behind the mic?
I wouldn't have made it to 1,000 episodes if I had been dictated by the hate mail that came in telling me to quit, stop, talking at the beginning of my show about me and my family and what's going on here.
Yeah.
You know, I got, and I probably could have an audience 50% bigger today if I would stop doing that. Now, believe it or not, Rob, but just based on, you know, I decided for the first time in 10 years, and this was this show kind of was the genesis of it. I changed my opening a little bit. And I still cover the same stuff. I just restacked it and trying to shorten it up a little bit. But that's the first major change ever to my startup of my show. And so far, no negative feedback. So the audience is going with it. We'll see what happens. If I lose some audience members, so be it. If I gain some, great. But I never run to the stats and look at my, you know, matter of fact, I rarely look at my own show stats now. I maybe once a month, or the email that comes in from the system, I look at it, I'm like, okay, it's about where it should be, and I move on. I don't do the show for the numbers. I do the, you know, I think if you love this space, you're doing the show because you love doing the show. And obviously, I've got a sponsor. I want to make sure the sponsors are happy. But I think most podcasters in the same, I would bet if we polled them, they would be in the same boat, minus the marketing folks. They have a very specific set agenda. And I feel sorry for them because they are so stovepiped.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wonder, well, first of all, I want to say this, you know, I don't ever look at my own podcasting stats because I just don't need another thing in my life to be depressed about. But on a more serious note, I guess. Another thing I see that it seems like a lot of people are asking about or are focusing on, and I see a lot of frustration early on, is this thing about, well, how do I grow my audience? And I've never believed that there was necessarily a mechanical way to do that, in the sense that, you know, there's a lot of information out there. A lot of people will say, well, you need to, you know, to optimize everything. Your show needs to go out at 6 a.m. on Monday morning. And then you need to tweet at 6:15 a.m., 9:30 a.m., you know, noon, 4 o'clock, whatever the thing is. And I've always kind of looked at all this stuff going, okay, that some of that stuff might help you pick up an occasional listener here and there. But like the way I consume podcasts, I listen to enough right now that I don't actually know when any of them come out because I'm a couple weeks behind, and I just have them stacked in a playlist and I listen for as long as I can. And then I hit pause and I go back and listen later. I really don't know when any of the shows I listen to publish, and I don't base my life around it, and it's on-demand media. Why would I? So there's that. But then this frustration happens with these new podcasters where I don't know where this expectation comes from, because certainly I never had it. And, after I am podcasting for X amount of weeks, months, or episodes, my audience is going to be at this point where I can presumably monetize at whatever level. And I don't know if either I'm just too realistic about this myself, or my own goals, expectations, or whatever are just different from everyone else's, or if there's information being put out there that, if say you follow a certain course or do this or do that, that, you know, I don't want to say guarantee, but if you follow these things that, you know, course creator person X did, then you'll have X amount of thousands of downloads in a certain amount of time or whatever. And this is how we get into these cycles where, you know, we see people who, of course, get obsessed with new and noteworthy. And then, you know, they get tied into that mythical 8-week period where they have to be on full throttle, 100%, all firing every cylinder to get into new and noteworthy. And maybe they do get in, maybe they don't. And then it's week 9 and they go, okay, I'm ready to rebrand and relaunch. Like, this is not how you build a thing in podcasting. It's a long tail game.
I just think, though, that sometimes again, it goes back to the times we're living. People want something. They want, you know, they want it in a specific time. They're not patient. You know, if folks knew how long it took to build my audience where it is today, they would quit. You know, they wouldn't even start. You know, it's just, you know, it's a, I know, I just, but it's a different mindset. And I think we have to understand that. But the new and noteworthy thing always, you know, I always roll my eyeballs and, you know, and people are like, it's like if they don't get in it, it's like life devastating.
It's a short burst of attention anyway. So
if a short burst that doesn't, you know, there's no bump.
Hey Todd, did you see this this article that came out in Medium this past week?
Yeah.
That kind of broke out what's going on in the podcasting space a little bit. Mm-hmm. I thought it was interesting.
That's a good article. That was probably one that you know, if once I get some data, I'll be able to confirm or deny those numbers. It's interesting. He thinks there's only 70,000 active shows.
Yeah, as far as active, but he did say that there was, 171,000?
There's 270.
Two seventy.
It's actually a little higher now, 277. But
Okay. Yeah, there you go. And then the number one category that had the most podcasts in it was podcasts about Christianity.
Yeah, I knew that already.
Wow.
About 39,000. And then music, which I thought was really interesting, 33,000.
Hardest to monetize category in the host space.
Yeah. You know, I have some friends who are music podcasters, and that is something you got to do for the love, because it's really hard to get a lot of traffic. I can't actually really name a music podcast that I would say is, you know, quote unquote popular or well known. Maybe Coverville comes to mind, but I don't know of too many that I can just rattle off the top of my head from that category where I can go, oh yeah, this is kind of a known thing. A lot of people know about it. It's one that you got to take on for the love, for sure.
Well, that, and there's a lot of copyright infringement going on there too. I know Spreaker has a lot of music podcasts, and there's a lot of people that are just pushing up stuff that they shouldn't be pushing up. In truth be told, about that stuff. I mean, when it says music podcast, it's not so much about talk about music, though that's a large percentage of it. I mean, a lot of it is like trance music or kind of mashup DJ music, that kind of stuff is what you see a lot of in that particular genre.
So do you, Rob, I don't, that's probably one category I should look into. I don't sample much. So the question, do you see then that there is, you know, they're not, it's not about PodSafe music. It's a lot about, you know, the stuff that they shouldn't be playing.
Well, I think that actually is across all the genres. I mean, it's not specific to music podcasts. I mean, there's a lot of people playing top 40 music in their podcasts and just doing it. You know, that's been going on since day one, actually, in this medium.
But are they doing samples or are they doing the full length song?
Well, some are doing full songs. Most of them, I mean, even Adam Curry did full songs for many years. Yeah, I don't know if you remember or not. But in his source code, he would play full tracks.
But he would do mostly PodSafe music. I don't think he was doing a lot of.
I think
he kind of went back and forth.
He was walking the line pretty close there for a while. I mean, he was playing stuff that maybe he shouldn't have been playing. I think he got slapped on the wrist a little bit at one point for doing it. Anyway, I mean, it's an area that's that is still an issue in the podcasting space. I mean, there's a lot of people that think it's okay to play, you know, regular music in there. And actually, I think a fair amount of it comes out of the radio industry, where they just take on-air content and then just push it up as a podcast and think, well, you know, we have the rights on the radio. We can just push it out as an episode, right? Downloadable, and we're perfectly fine. I think there's just a lot of lack of knowledge about this stuff.
And one thing that, you know, we have a DMCA agent, all the stuff, you know, if someone required us to take down some content, you know, we have all the provisions to comply with that. I can't tell you anytime in any recent years where we were asked to take down because of music. So the is it just flying underneath the radar of the ASCAP, BMI, RIAA?
Yeah, I think in a lot of ways. I mean, I do on a fairly regular basis hear about people that have had that they've gotten letters where they have to stop. I don't believe that anybody's getting sued or taken to court or anything. I think there's just cease and desist letters that go out and the content provider just stops doing it. And but you're exactly right. Most of these shows are so under downloaded, right, or have such a low profile that nobody's following it or
small.
Even wants to spend the time to to do all of the digging that you have to do to find out if they're compliant or not.
Well, there is no compliant.
Well, that's true.
There is no license. Everyone's infringing.
Yeah. There's gradients, right? If you're playing a sample, right, are they going to really push that hard? But if you're playing full tracks, you know, there's one podcast that I know that's done up here in Seattle that's he has, you know, some independent artists that will come in on and go on his podcast. I know KEXP up here in Seattle does the same thing where they do live performances where the artist will actually come in and actually perform for the podcast.
Well, that's immediately requiring, irregardless of any copyright, requires a BMI license.
Yeah. Well, that's a radio station too. So they're doing that too, but there are independent groups that will say you have full rights to do this that aren't affiliated with any BMI or ASCAP.
Yeah.
That this one podcast that I'm talking about, what we'll do, they'll come on and they'll have a conversation and they'll it's like a comedy podcast and they'll play one of the full tracks.
Right.
And they've gotten all the sign off rights and all that kind of stuff.
Smart.
So there is a spectrum here, and then there's trance music, which can, you know, anybody can sit, you know, if they have a music equipment in their bedroom or whatever, they can make their own music and that kind of stuff. I think there's a fair amount of that going on too.
And I think there's, like you said, many shades of gray.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, the big thing that, one of the things that happened recently with SoundCloud, and this doesn't really impact podcasting directly, but they got, they issued a whole bunch of takedowns of, on the music side. Because a lot of DJs, like Rob is mentioning, you know, a lot of DJs and electronic kind of mix mashup-y type artists were posting stuff there. And, you know, they were using uncleared samples. So when the record labels found out, they just started firing off, you know, takedown requests. And, you know, tons of stuff has been purged recently from SoundCloud on the music side. And I know kind of the podcasting side is different, but the point is that there are times when, you know, the groups out there that police this stuff, they are on the lookout, you know?
And and they go in streaks. All of a sudden they'll get a wild hair and then they'll target someone. It's like they have a committee meeting. So, okay, this week we're going after suchandsuch.com and we're going to get some negative publicity, and, you know, because it's all money play. They want their cash, and they should, you know, if they're using copyrighted music, the artists are deserving of a royalty. And, you know, they got to eat too. So I understand the reasonings for this, but, anyway, we are, at, an hour 23 here. And Rob, just and for the audience as well, definitely will be here next Saturday for a show. There will be a potential that I may not be here on the 19th. I'll let you know on that, Rob. But have you been working on the schedule at all from a lineup perspective?
Yeah, I don't have anybody booked right now for next Saturday, but I'll get a good guest on for next. I mean, not to say that we didn't have one this week. I'm just saying I'll get a good guest on.
I understand. I was kind of last minute fill in today, which I'm totally happy with.
I didn't mean that at all.
So I understand.
Right? The next episode is episode 100 of the New Media Show.
Oh, wow. Congratulations.
So we should, I tell you, we really should try to get Adam or Dave or somebody like that on.
I've tried to get Dave on before. He won't do it.
He won't do it. Interesting. Yeah. Dave doesn't do interviews at all.
No, he doesn't. I mean, so he used to. I mean, he and Adam used to do shows together. But
yeah, I wonder why Dave. He just
I don't know. I mean, you could. I mean,
I'll email him
To reach out to him again and ask him.
Yeah, so it'd be nice if we could get Dave or Adam or see who else we could bring in. And then we don't have to have a super special guest for 100.
Well,
it might be kind of cool.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
And it's been fun doing the show today. It's been kind of nice just to kind of chit chat about the space, and the folks been in the chat room have been busy. So thank all of you that have been in the chat room. But if you have comments or you have a guest suggestion for the show, you can email Rob or I at Todd or Rob at newmediashow.com. That'll get to both of us, and or what, you know, one or the other. Then one thing I will self plug here is we're decided, and the reason I bought all this gear for the studio is we're going to be launching a more regular show at Rob Voice, and it's going to take over the periodic content that I do on PowerPress podcast. It is basically the Blueberry podcast for the PowerPress community. We're rebranding that, and there's going to be a show that's going to be put out on a regular basis. So the way we're going to work it is we're going to rebrand and have that show go into the existing feed as audio only. And then when I have any special product announcements, actually are company related, that will go strictly into the video channel. There won't be any crossing of the streams for content. So you're listening to the show, you know, on a regular basis, and then all of a sudden it bounces to me making a product announcement. So there will be a segregation there so that the business side will be separated from the show side. And I'm excited because we're going to mix it up by every week. There'll be a primary co-host, a primary host, and then every week there will be a different co-host from the company. So we'll be making the rounds. You'll get to meet the entire company and hear about their, and we're doing assignments. Every content, every person's going to be talking about a topic. It's not going to be a sales pitch. That's not the purpose of the show. But we are going to be talking about different topics. And we've collectively got, you know, nearly 100 years of podcasting experience between us, between legal, graphics, the, you know, tech side, the marketing, everything. So we're going to rotate folks in. It'll be, I think, a little different type of show. So again, if folks are already subscribed to the PowerPress podcast, they'll start getting that next week when we put out the first episode. I'll probably be announcing it in both feeds today, and then it'll switch to the new format next week.
Yeah, I also wanted to mention quickly that September 18th through the 20th is LA PodFest.
Oh, yeah.
Happening. So if you happen to be in the Los Angeles area, you might want to look that event up. It looks like it's turning out to be a pretty good event this year. So its lead sponsor is Audible. And
I wonder if they're going to be making an announcement there.
I would not be surprised. They've been hiring a lot of people over there around original content for podcasting. So the question gets back into is how wide a distribution is that content going to have?
Right. And I heard a rumor that someone else might be looking to get into original content. So a lot of original content play happening here.
Somebody else, huh?
Yeah. Were you the one that told me that, or did someone else? Anyway, I don't know if I'm allowed to say who it was, but we may see more players come in on the original content play. The International Podcast Day is happening again on September 30th. Yep. So keep that marked on your calendar to celebrate that day, to be able to promote it on social, on your shows, build awareness about the podcasting community if you want to learn about that. We had that with Steve Lee last week on the last week's show. But it's been fun today. Thanks, Sean.
Thanks, Sean.
It was great to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I was great to talk to you guys this morning.
And we will be back with you next Saturday for another edition of the New Media Show. My name is Todd Cochran. Of course, I want to thank my co-host, Mr. Rob Greenlee. And thanks for being here.
Thank you, Todd. Happy to be here.
All right, everyone. We'll see you next time. Take care.
Okay.
Aloha.
Bye.
Bye.